The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Out here in the perimeter, there are no stars. Out here, we is stoned, immaculate.
Hello and welcome. This is the C86 show. I'm David Eastall. As you know, we love a special guest. This week it's going to be the turn of the musician John Ford, who I spoke to very recently to find out more about life, love and poetry. One-time member of Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera, also the Straubs for quite a few years, famous for writing Part of the Union. Then the Monks, who was also famous for Nice Legs, Shame About the Face, but has been in various other musical combos and has been sort of playing with the Straubs occasionally, you know, on various albums that have come out and also anniversary dates, etc., which you'll find out much more in this interview. So anyway, after several minutes of interesting but casual chat, we get down to that exciting subject that was the early formative years. John, it's over to you.
Well, when I was a lot younger, because I was born in 48, actually, which is disgusting.
Yes.
But anyway, so I grew up as a child in the 50s, and my biggest sort of influence because I started to sing and play around that time when I was a kid. So my grandmother bought me a ukulele, and I got a 6-string guitar and figured that out. And my biggest influence of that time was a guy called Lonnie Donegan.
Yes.
He recorded, he was like before the Beatles, he was the biggest thing in England, and he did a take on which a lot of people didn't realise, and I certainly didn't as a child. He took a lot of Woody Guthrie, you know, the American folk singer songs, and made them his own, you know.
Yes.
And Lead Belly as well, the blues singer. And he was like the biggest thing, you know. He was a big pop star, you know, before 1960 hit, and the, you know, we had Cliff Richard and the Shadows was a big influence on me.
Yes, absolutely.
I don't know. When I first heard of, as a child, I was always very into, even though I couldn't read music and I didn't really understand. I got bored with the doo-wop period, you know, where there were most of the songs were constructed of C, A minor, F and G, ba 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 da ba ba da ba da ba da. All the songs were like that, and I really got bored even at like 10 or 11 years old. And then when I heard the Shadows do a patchy with all these minor, because I thought, what the hell is this? This is fantastic. So as a child, I was into, you know, a lot of things, you know, and that's what got me into sort of writing songs.
Yes, I know. I think Bob Dylan was a huge Lonnie Donegan fan as well, actually, from reading various articles. And John Peel was a huge fan of Lonnie. So, it was the ultimate thing. So when we came to sort of that early sort of 60s period, there was the great moment, wasn't there? Music started to change drastically. Before that, were you sort of interested in, that kind of Elvis and Little Richard time and Buddy Holly and Eddie Cochran, you know, rock and roll?
Well, yeah, I was aware of it. My father was, you know, the record buyer in the family. So we had all, you know, we had Little Richard, definitely Elvis, and all that stuff. I was, you know, not so much Buddy Holly. My father didn't buy Buddy Holly for some reason. So it was Lonnie Donegan, Elvis, Bill Haley and the Comets, which, believe it or not, you know, Rock Around the Clock, right? I was on Top of the Pops when Rock Around the Clock resurfaced.
And, excellent.
When I was in Hudson Ford, we did a show on Top of the Pops with Bill Haley. I couldn't believe it, you know.
Amazing.
That was it. And he sang that song, you know. I don't know whether he had the same band, but he sang it just as good as on the record, you know. But yeah, all that stuff was a big influence on me.
Yes.
During that period.
Your parents were obviously very hip to the trip then, because, you know, my parents, who I love, but they were, you know, much more into that country sound. I mean, my dad liked Elvis, but he was quite young during the war period, and they, you know, obviously liked people like the Andrews Sisters, and there was other people like Teresa Brewer and these sort of slight, sort of singer-songwriters that, not singer-songwriter, you know, like slightly lounge, not Elvis, not Frank Sinatra, but people like, these kind of women singers that, I mean, they were okay.
My father was always into all the rock stuff, really, I suppose.
Yes. And you grew up in London, didn't you, as well?
Yeah, Fulham, place called Fulham.
Fulham, yes. But then Craven Cottage. Did you, how did the war sort of, I mean, obviously survived it because you wouldn't be here, but... Oh.
Sorry, sorry that my...
That's fine.
...girlfriend came in there.
This is life. Yeah, no, but what was the war period like for your family? Did they talk about
the war?
Yes, the Second World War.
Not much, really. No.
No.
I don't really... I mean, I was aware of it. I mean, my mum used to say we couldn't get, you know, food or oranges or bananas during the war. But I didn't really... No, I mean, I didn't have much experience. I mean, as a kid, I mean, you know, what goes on before you, you're not really interested in.
No, absolutely. But I just, that was amazing. So look, 1964, brilliant year, mainly because I was born. But this is when you formed your first band.
64 at school, yeah. And again, this was another big milestone for me because, again, as when I heard Apache, change my sort of musical style, when I heard the Beatles, that was, with all their chords I'd never heard of, put in pop songs, you know. And so even though I was already playing, you know, and singing at school, I met a guy at school and we sort of got together, started writing songs, and that formed my sort of first band called James Fender and the Vulcans in around 1964, yeah.
Such a great name. Why was the bass the instrument of choice at that point?
It wasn't actually, because when I grew up, as I said before, my grandmother bought me a ukulele and I went on to, you know, a proper guitar. I can't remember exactly what happened, but the bass player left in the band, and it was it's a bit like Paul McCartney. I was sort of, you know, ushered into playing the bass, and my father very nicely went out and bought me, Paul, because I was into the Beatles. Paul McCartney bought me the old Hofner, you know, bass, and that's how I started playing the bass in James Fender and the Vulcans.
Blimey.
And you know, when you play the guitar already, you know basically what a bass guitar, you know, is supposed to do within a band, you know, whereas if you can't really sit at home with a bass guitar. And although a lot of kids do, I see on the internet, writing a song on the bass or practicing on your own on the bass is a very difficult instrument to do without having people, you know, around you.
Yes, I know. I see a lot of kids, kind of incredible musicians, but just on their own in their room, sort of posting these little bits up of classic rock songs from their probably grandfather's generation. It's amazing, really.
Some of them are really good. I mean, it's a pity to, with the advent of the internet, it's done a lot of musicians a lot of good. In the same time, it's like ruined the music business, you know. two different, one extreme to the other. So you get these kids play brilliantly and, you know, in their bedroom and post these things, but where they go from there is not, you know.
Yes.
Next thing you see them playing on the street. And again, you see these kids playing on the street. But, you know, it's... definitely taken a toll on music business.
Yes. So then you obviously, that perfect age, you know, that sort of experienced that kind of change of the 60s from sort of, I know it's a bit of a cliche, from black and white to that kind of 67, the Summer of Love, where they had, I think it was a gathering of the tribes in San Francisco with people like the Grateful Dead and Allen Ginsberg, and then the 14-hour Technicolor Dream in Ali Pali with Pink Floyd. Did you sort of get quite hooked on that kind of musical transition during that period.
Oh, yeah, yeah, without a doubt, yeah. Because I sort of fell into it, because I was... after I left James Fender and Vocals, I joined a band called... because I had a job, you know, I was working in menswear. And every week I would look in the Melody Maker for, you know, Bass Player Wanted. And there I saw it one day, Bass Player Wanted. I remember the ad, Must Be on the Ball. And I turned up and Richard Hudson, who I was to be with for the rest of my career, or most of it, yes. was already the drummer in James Friend and the Vulcans. They picked me to be the bass player. And they were like a soul band, you know, a cover soul band, which I knew absolutely nothing about. I sort of faked my way into this band because I was into like Cliff Richard and the Beatles. But anyway, so that's morphed into Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera. And during that period, I was doing a lot of session work for other people in Denmark Street in London. And the flower power thing, it was all the, you know, it was all the rage. I mean, you know, walking around with beads around your neck, and my mum made me a caftan sort of, you know, smock sort of thing. And it was a great period. And the same with all the shows. It was like, you know, wafts of marijuana coming across the stage. And
did you?
It was actually a great period. It was fun.
Yeah, did you go to places like was it UFO with Joe Boyd and Miles? God, what's his name?
Yeah, I went to all those places. Not that we played all of them, but I think there was a place called the Middle Earth in Covent Garden.
Yes, that's the one.
Downstairs. I remember doing the first gig with Elmer Gantry and Fairport Convention there. And they said, oh, you're so good, you guys. And we said, this is our first show. We haven't played anywhere. But anyway, yeah, and I used to go to the Roundhouse, and the Lyceum was the one in the... That was also in Covent Garden. That was a big venue as well. Yeah, I mean, I was,
it was
a fantastic time.
And what was it like when you sort of suddenly saw people like Hendrix coming over, or hearing Jefferson Aeroplane for you, you know, as a musician, and hearing such a, in the Doors and people like that? Was that quite...
Well,
interesting.
Well, believe it or not, in the days before iPhones, when no one took any pictures, I actually played with Hendrix, because Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera used to do an overnight sort of spot, a weekly spot in the Speakeasy.
Right.
It was a big club called the Speakeasy. And we were down there on one of our nights, you know, we didn't get paid a lot. We couldn't even afford to buy a drink down, it was so expensive. We used to sit around with four straws sipping out of a can of Coke. That's how bad it was. And anyway, Hey Joe, Hendrix's first hit, was at the top of the charts. And we were down there and we were playing, and it was going around that he was in the club. And lo and behold, he walked up to us and said, could I jump on the guitar and play with you? So a guitarist got down, and for a couple of songs there, it was Hudson, Ford, and Hendrix.
Oh my god!
Of course, there was no videos of that, because there weren't any cell phones, you know. Mm. And then I think what happened, I got down, he got on my bass, but there was a couple of other, you know, I can't remember. Maybe Eric, I don't know who was down there. I can't remember. And then it came into this, you know, into this big jam with Jimi Hendrix. He was quite an unassuming sort of guy. I imagined him more, I don't know, he was not larger than life when I saw him.
No.
But very polite, you know. And also it coincided, for some reason, the place got raided. I don't know, the police came down. So I am the chief of police, and everybody cheered, you know. And whether they knew Jimmy was down there, I do not know. But yeah, so for a while there, it was Hudson, Ford, and Hendrix.
Blimey, that is such a great moment, isn't it?
You know what? He got up on stage, grabbed our guitars, was very finicky with his sound, you know. Hendrix got up there. He had a right-handed guitar. He turned his guitar to the left, upside down, and played it like as it was, you know, with the strings all the wrong way around. And he immediately turned all his volume controls on his Marshall amp, you know, full on, you know. Sounded great.
Yes. And did it have that quality that you kind of recognised straight away, thinking, God, how does he do
what,
that?
From Jimmy?
Yeah, Jimmy.
What, from Jimmy? Oh, yeah, yeah. He played as he normally played. Unbelievably upside down. Yeah. We've still got the... And when he got on my bass, we've still got that bass. I don't have it in America, but Hudson owns it now.
Yes.
Still got that bass that he played on, yeah. And that was with me all the way through my career. I used that bass on the Five Proud Walkers, Zelma Gantry's The Straw, Sutton Ford, and all the load of other stuff we did.
Touched by Hendrix. God, that's quite something, isn't it?
Touched by.
That's some, yes. I know, amazing, though. I mean, you know, when you're young and you first hear Hendrix, it's always something, isn't it, really, for my generation, I suppose. But, yeah. And what was it like going in the studio? Because you did, you know, an album with the band, but was that 68, wasn't it?
Are you talking with what? What, Elmer Gantry's?
Yes, Elmer Gantry.
James Fender and the Vulcans.
No, Elmer Gantry.
Let me go back a bit, because James Fender and the Vulcans, we, believe it or not, had a record out on Parlophone. There was some competition called Ready, Steady, Win. It was like a Ready, Steady, Go, Ready, Steady, Win. And we never won, but we got a record deal out of it, and we had a record out on Parlophone called Mistletoe Love, and then we were on the album. And that was a big deal in those days for sort of an unknown band to get a deal, you know, on an EMI label. That was good. But then when we never got another record deal until we were in, although we were recording with the Five Proud Walkers, we never got a record deal until we formed Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera. And we had sort of a near miss hit record with a song called Flames.
Right.
Which was played at that time. There were a lot of pirate radio stations, and they were playing it up. But
yes,
it never cracked the charts, I don't think, but it got around. I
mean, yes. Were you tuning into that, you know, the John Peel Perfume Garden kind of vibe as well?
Oh, yeah, I used to listen to all that. Yeah, sure. He used to play our stuff a lot, I think.
I would imagine.
Remember that, yeah. He was, yeah, we did a lot of stuff for the BBC, Saturday Club, all those sort of live shows. You know, like the Beatles had, you know, the BBC Live album.
Yes.
We did all those, and they're flying around somewhere. But, yeah, it was a very busy time between that, the shows, and my session work. And I was on a lot of, like, hit records, Home and Summit, Dave D, Dozy, Beaky, Mick and Titch, loads of stuff I played bass on, you know.
Yes, I could imagine. Was it Jimmy Page was very similar, wasn't he? He was kind of appeared.
Yeah, before he was in Led Zeppelin, yeah.
Yeah. Did you, at that stage, because it kind of so much was changing, and there was like these kind of quite progressive folk bands like Comus, who was sort of happening, and there was the Incredible String Band, and then you had that birth of kind of prog rock with a band called, I think, either 1-2-3 or Clouds that David Bowie loved, as well as that psychedelic world. How were you sort of digesting all this? Because there was so much, that not much had happened before. You know, obviously we had, you know, the blues and we had jazz and Presley, but there was just so much music opening up. And as a musician,
there was always that sideline of the folk artists, you know, that started with Bob Dylan, you know, and people like the Seekers, you know, the Australian band.
Yes.
That they were like, you know, they sold as many records as the Beatles. And there was always that, you know, especially over here in America with, you know, the singer, folk singer, songwriter, you know. I would have done well at that time, actually.
Yes.
That and doesn't happen anymore.
And a young Al Stewart,
yeah,
as well.
It was, Al Stewart, yeah, all that stuff. It was still going. And that, you know, and that's how the Straubs started, because they, you know, unbeknownst to me, around 64, 65, 67, they were doing this, you know, they were like a bluegrass band, a three-piece bluegrass band, which I'd heard of them, but I wasn't aware of that because we were far more into the rock and roll stuff, you know, with the Elmer Gantry's. Yeah, it was a hell of a lot of music. It was a great, you know, the whole of the, you know, it. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen anymore.
No, not.
I don't know what it's like in England, but here it's terrible. I mean, I'm living in what I call cover band land. I mean, it's like on Long Island, it's like you can't do anything unless you're a cover band. Nobody listens to any new music anymore, unless it's like, you know, the really big artists, like we've got Taylor Swift appearing at the Coliseum here. But, you know, underneath Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and a couple of the other big guys, there's nothing. It's like a big drop into, you know, the cover band.
Yes, you know? This is, I know, and DJs. People love DJs, don't they? I mean, sort of, obviously the 60s started brilliantly, had a great middle bit, and then it kind of finished with, you know, the death of Brian Jones, Hendrix, Joplin, Jim Morrison and Altamont, which was obviously horrendous. How did that feel for you? Did it, you know, because it's kind of a change of a decade often has a little bit of a odd feeling when you think, God, it's the 70s. What's happened now?
And well, then when they all died.
When they died, yes. So, yes. How so drastically?
Yeah, it felt like an end of an. It felt like an end of an era. I mean, although I wasn't too much into, you know, Janis Joplin. I like more of a. I know she was a great singer and stuff, but and Jim Morrison, the Doors sound better now than I remember them. And what I noticed, because you hear a lot of the Doors over here, and they were actually a weird sort of, I don't know, sort of a jam band that morphed into sort of good songs. I mean, and he had a good image and voice. Yeah, it was like an end of an era when it broke, you know, just before the 70s, I suppose.
Yes.
And everyone ditched their, you know, beads and stuff.
Yes. Well, it's interesting.
I mean, that drummer, Richard Hudson, he used to wear so many beads, he couldn't hold his head up, you know.
Yes, because, you know, people like Bowie had gone into some sort of straightforward, you know, R&B bands, and he tried folk and then he more folk and then singer-songwriter, yeah, and then he sort of got his glam period. And then obviously you sort of leave the band in that period with Richard. What was that a big decision to leave the band and join the Stroops?
You're talking about Elmer Gantry?
Yeah.
Well, actually, what happened with Elmer Gantry was we made the first album, and the which was what was it called? Just Elmer Gantry's Velvet Opera, right? And we struggled to. We were doing shows and stuff, you know, but we struggled to after Flames never really hit to make the big time. And the album was, I suppose, it was received okay. And we got on a compilation album called. The Rock Machine Turns You On, with a lot of American bands.
Oh,
and everyone
yes.
thought we were American. Yeah, that was so Flames was on that. But then Elmer left, because things weren't going, you know, and I can't remember the exact thing why. And we had a guy in the band called Paul Brett who replaced our original guitars. And we made a second Velvet Opera album, not Elmer Gantry's, a Velvet Opera album, which was more folky. And we wrote in a folk singer from Hammersmith called Johnny Joyce, who was had a very good voice, and he played the 12-string guitar. And that second album was more folky. I like it. I still think it was good. But then again, we did very few shows. One of the shows we did do, which got me into the Straubs, got me and Hudson into the Straubs. We played a show at the White Bear in Hounslow, which was a pub that Dave Cousins ran. As a sort of a folky arts lad thing
yes.
every week. David Bowie was there. He had a lot of sort of up-and-coming artists there. And one of the few gigs we did do as the Velvet Opera with Johnny Joyce and Paul Bear was in that place. And Dave must have seen us. I never spoke to him. He must have seen us. And anyway, that comes to the, if you want to talk about the next section. So the band wasn't really doing much, and we're talking about 1969. And then I heard that the Straubs, who were getting a name for themselves, were looking for a bass player. And so I turned up at the White Bear on my own and making out to Dave that, you know, did he have any more shows at the White Bear? And he said, no, but we're looking for a bass player. And after about five or six pints, I was in the band.
Yes, I know. The best, yes.
And then after another couple of pints, Richard Hudson was in the band.
Fantastic. That's such a good...
Yeah, yeah. That's how that happened.
Yeah,
and Rick Wakeman, who I'd known from doing sessions, was already there. I said, Rick, what are you doing here? He said, I'm in the Straubs. Because it was Rick Wakeman, Dave Cousins, Tony Hooper, and they had a bass player, Ron Chesterman or Lindsay Cooper, I can't remember.
Yes.
So it was all set up and we joined, and 6 weeks after that, we made that album, believe it or not, the Antiques and Curios.
That's just amazing. Yes, because, Bowie used to have an arts lab thing, didn't he, down in South London, and tried to create a bit of a scene. I guess creating scenes in the late 60s was a thing that everyone was trying at that time, because it was a sort of a lot of experimental kind of theatre companies with Mime, Lindsay Kemp and people like that.
Mime, yeah, we had in fact, one of our tours we had, and I think Dave got that from David Bowie, because I think David Bowie appeared at his club miming, just miming.
Yes.
And I remember we had this opening act and he was just a mime, Personally, not my thing.
No, quite tricky. Being a support band at the best of times is tricky, but mime, quite tricky, isn't it? Yes, because Rick Wakeman, because I had a brother who was 7 years older and he was into prog and the solo work of Rick Wakeman. So I became quite obsessed with Rick in the 70s and late 70s. So yes, what was Rick like? Because this is pre-Yes, wasn't it? But an amazing,
Rick was exactly like he is now, full of stories. And full of jokes.
Jokes. He tells his jokes.
The same as great guy. I mean, we got on well. He was a terrific piano player. I mean, what he did with the Straub stuff was and if you listen to that Antiques and Curios live album, it was great. I mean, for the time we had when we got together.
Yes.
And we went in there and did that. And for me, coming from El Magantri's Velvet Opera, where it was all noisy, people throwing bottles, drunk, all that stuff, I suppose because of my experience in sessions playing a lot of other stuff, I immediately loved playing in the Straws because people listened. They clapped after each song. Dave explained all the songs. You could hear the bass. And I've always, with Dave Cousins' tunes, if you listen to a lot of my bass playing on all those four albums, his tunes are very good, at least for me, to follow and make lines up on the bass. I always had that thing with his stuff.
Yes.
And it was, I made it. And the same with Hudson, even though he came from this big, drum smashing band. He didn't have a drum kit, first of all, Antiques and Curios. He just had congas, a cymbal, and a tambourine. It was more of like an acoustic act.
But
it was great. I mean, immediately, I loved it immediately.
And what was it like? Because you had Tony Visconti, who went on to do T-Rex and obviously Bowie. So what was... Do you remember much about being in the studio during that recording?
Yeah, well, the first time I met Tony was in the bathroom of... Air Studios, and he's washing his hair in the sink. I won't tell you on the air what he said to me, why he was washing his hair, but anyway. But yeah, he produced, he had some dealings with Dave before I joined the band, as far as like a range, and he was an up-and-coming producer, and he was very good with, orchestrations, and he arranged a couple of things before I was actually in the band on the very first album. I can't remember,
Yes,
I can't remember that. But anyway, so the album after Antiques and Curios from the Witchwood, he produced that, and which had Hangman and the Papist, Rick on the Rick was on the piano and synthesizers and all that sort of stuff, and so that was working with, he was good.
Yes, and on the second album for you anyway, Witchwood, you write 30 Days, don't you? And also Keep the Devil Outside.
Keep the Devil Outside. Was that on the album? That may have been a B-side for Benedictus, I think.
Right.
But Tony Hooper was singing that, yeah.
And what was the process and the general vibe like for doing Witchwood? Was the band on sort of on a bit of a sort of creative high at this stage?
It certainly was creative. Rick... apparently, I wasn't too aware of it, but Rick was apparently at that time rehearsing with Yes. And obviously, they made him an offer he couldn't refuse. And after the recording of from the Witchwood, he did leave. But there wasn't any animosity there. I mean, we were used to him, he had so much session work, because at that time, I think he played on David Bowie's Space Oddity.
That's right, yeah.
Not Oddity, Odyssey. And, so there was... He had a lot going on, so he was in and out of the studio. Some, like on 30 days, he wasn't actually on that. And so we just got on with, you know, that, you know, that was the way it was. I mean, he was, in and out. And then when our management told us he was joining us, it really didn't come as any big surprise,
No. Yes, and I think it was also, I can't remember, I think it was Life on Mars as well he was on. But then when he...
Yeah, did all that. Yeah.
When he left, you quickly replaced him anyway. So this was the early 70s. Did... At that stage, I mean, because there had been the world of, I suppose, heavy rock started to come in, and then obviously the glam period. So with the band, did you feel like you had your own sort of niche at this point in the kind of the charts and in the singles chart?
Well, we weren't actually, during the Witchwood period, we hadn't charted yet. But if we call it a niche, it was basically Dave Cousins, who's always been... and always will be, I suppose. He's always been the mainstay of the Stalls with his songwriting, and so all those albums, Witchwood included, was basically we're all riding on what he was writing. And although my song in on that 30 Days was like nothing really, people say it was a bit of an odd track. It was more poppy than the rest of it. But, that's what I was writing at the time, and I didn't... Whereas when we got into Grave New World, I sort of eased into, more of what Dave was writing and what was expected of the Straubs then,
Yes, so, I know. Because in the next one, Bursting at the Seams,
Grave New World. Grave New World.
Oh, Grave New World. But then the sort of the 73 one, Bursting at the Seams, this is where you have two more sort of songs on the album, or three more actually, don't you? You do quite a few on this one. So is that kind of a recording and sort of writing process, did that change much on that sort of third album with the band?
It was still, everyone was like, I suppose more people were chipping in by then. We had Dave Lambert, the lead guitarist, and he was also writing. So we had like four writers, myself, Richard Hudson, Dave Cousins and Dave Lambert. But it was still at the helm, it was still Dave and his lyrics and songs.
Yes.
And we were sort of easing in toward that, Although part of the Union, which was, a big hit for the Straubs, when I wrote that, I didn't actually... and I was working... Hudson and I formed this... we were like a Hudson Ford writing team. We decided to become a Hudson Ford writer because, Dave was writing on his own and Hudson and I, who had been sort of, writing songs since Elmer Gantry's, decided to... Well, we're going to split everything. We'll do it, like the Beatles and that sort of stuff.
Yes.
And part of the Union was not meant to be a Straubs, contribution. We were going to release it on its own as under the title of The Brothers or something, But then, the management heard it, the label heard it, and they decided to include it on the Straubs album. Nothing to do with me.
Yes. And, can you remember where was that song written? Because to be honest, that was one of those songs that, from my childhood, it was on the radio for us such a long time, wasn't it? We heard it everywhere.
Actually, I still do this now, but I tend to... Sometimes I don't write anything for about 2 years. At the moment, I'm halfway through another solo album. Sometimes I wonder why I keep doing them. Anyway, so I've got about half a dozen tracks, and now I won't... I'm giving it a break until I go to after the Straub shows, because I like these long breaks. It gives me a lot of inspiration. So in answer to your question, part of the Union, I actually wrote that with two other songs. I wrote that with... and I sort of flip between, I go back, I do a bit, I do it. I wrote that with Burn Baby Burn, which was to become a hit for Hudson Ford. And a song on our first album, Hudson Ford album, called I Wanted You. I was fiddling around with all those three songs all in one afternoon up in my sister's bedroom, believe it or not.
Right.
When I was still living at home.
Yes, because the 70s was kind of famous for sort of strikes and unions. Was it just kind of in your...
Well, there, obviously, it had a big effect on... And that song, even though, you know, we met Jack Jones of the Transport General Workers, when I'm there, they took it as their own, you know, union song, which it was right, you know, the chorus is a union song, but the rest of it is because it's a sarcastic look at what the trade unions... And, you know, I'm a union guy, I'm in the musician's union, you know, you could not join if you were on Top of the Pops, you had to join anyway.
Yes.
But anyway, so the verses are, you know, how powerful a union guy had become. I'm a union man, and me, well, you know, sort of stuff. You know. But, you know, everyone, you know, apparently loved it.
So they loved it. It just went...
Tony Blackburn used to say, rushed out. In the old days, when you used to rush out and buy a record, now you don't do that anymore.
No, the singles. Well, they'd enter at number 42 and then go to 36 and then 28. And
yeah,
it was a long, and Sunday evenings or afternoons, we used to listen to the radio, being very excited to know if a song went up five places and would get played, because that's the only time you could hear a record. So,
it was great. You either bought a record or it was on the radio or it was on TV. You had no other access to that. And that was great because that's what's wrong with the business now. Kids now, they have access to anything without paying for it. Bands don't even, you know, bands release their albums on the internet because they know people are going to get it anyway, you know.
Yes,
ridiculous.
I know. Little did you realize. But then, obviously, a bit like a lot of bands, when they get that single, the tour. Did that suddenly? Did your next, you know, like tour with the band just have a totally different atmosphere with a big sort of hit single?
Oh yeah, 73 was our, you know, I think the part of the union was released in January of 73, and we had. You know, the tours were like wild. I mean, they really were in England. And we did, you know, in Europe as well. We were never big in France for some reason. I don't remember the tours going to France. And then, of course, we had the American tours, which unions aren't so powerful over here.
No.
Part of the union didn't mean that much over here. But we had some good tours over here.
Yeah, yes.
Good. But, yeah, you're right. It was pretty wild. I mean...
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You know, things I can't even repeat over the radio.
No, it was a different period, wasn't it? I know, it's like one of those things we all just smile when you. Yeah, that was kind of interesting. But did you have an American kind of audience? And the other thing with a lot of bands I've interviewed from Britain is that tour in America often finishes them off a bit. They come back a little bit like they've been to Vietnam. They're a bit shell-shocked and a bit like, God, what was that? You know, they don't know who they are and where they're living anymore. They're just a bit knackered. So,
yeah, well, it can be, yeah. But I personally, I'm one of those people who love living in hotels. I mean, to me, I could be on the road all the time. But they were very... When you looked at the tour, the tour guide and saw 6 weeks of shows. It was a bit, you know, bloody hell, 6 weeks. Especially, you know, I just met this girl, you know, and I went over to America. It was like, I'm sorry, I've got to go.
Yes.
Stay for 6 weeks.
Yes.
But America, you know, the first time we went was like, was the greatest time of my life. I mean, we came from, in fact, I think we went to America before we hit it really big in 72. I think we went in 72, actually.
Right.
Yeah, when we had Grave New World out, yeah. And we flew to Los Angeles, A&M Records, had a big limousine. Oh, my God. We stayed at the Continental Hyatt House, which, like, you know, Led Zeppelin was there, and they were playing on Long Beach. We had about three nights in the Whiskey A Go-Go. It was, like, the greatest time.
Oh my God.
Unbelievable.
The whiskey.
And the weather, you know, we up on the roof in the pool, everyone got rage. it was absolutely fantastic. And so it set us up for the rest of the tour, the weather wasn't quite as good when you go to Chicago and all that places. But it was still great. Yeah, it was, I loved it personally. You know.
I would imagine, yes. Mick Fleetwood was the same. He just said he loved that, going to a hotel, clean towels, little soaps, you know.
It's great, yeah.
No,
it really is.
Room service, just enjoy it, yeah. You know, and more than anything, which is, I think it's either, and Lemmy was probably the same. It was just rock and roll was in his blood, really. Mm. So that was good. Then then you sort of become the Monks. What's the scenario behind from the Straubs to the Monks happening?
Well, it wasn't the Straubs. We left the Straubs and Hudson and I and Fog Hudson Ford. And we had like a string of hits with them whilst Dave formed another band, under the Straubs, and they went on to make very big albums, you know, or Ghosts and Hero and Heroine, who actually were bigger albums in America than they were in England at that time. And so we made a couple of our albums were, Dave Cousins always said, we had the hit records and they had the hit albums. And if we'd have stayed together, we might have been, as you know, a lot bigger than what we are now. But, you know, who knows?
Was it a big decision leaving the Straubs at that stage? Or was it just what?
No, it mainly was because of the, between me, Hudson, and Dave Cousins, as far as like songwriting in the band, basically was what it. And it's very hard in a band when you've, you know, some of these bands, you know, you get one songwriter, he's a millionaire, and the rest of them are just on wages.
Yes.
But when you get a band where there's a lot of contributions coming from all sides, it can get a bit heated. And looking back on it, I would have done things a lot different now in the Straubs, instead of, like, you know, making these camps and stuff, you know, what we had.
Yes.
And Dave Cousins went one way with the Straubs and we went our way with Hudson Ford. And we, you know, we had Pick Up the Pieces, Floating in the Wind, and, you know, but then we never, touring-wise, we never did that much. We went to America. We did all the stuff, but it sort of wound down a bit when the punk movement came along.
Yes,
and I personally started to feel a bit out of date with the stylistic singing. You know, there were these great voices, and we were like struggling to, you know, find another hit record after Floating in the Wind, and it sort of went to, it sort of died a bit, you know. And then the Monks was a fluke, the Monks. I wrote this song called Nice Leg Showing About the Face.
Yes, a classic.
Made it a demo with our publishers because we were still under the same management. So Hudson and I recorded this demo, which was actually the hit record. So we sent it off with a bunch of other stuff. And this label came back and said, we'd like this song, we'd like to do it. So we said, well, when are we going, okay, we'll record it properly. They said, no, we love it as is, because it sounded like the punk thing. So accidentally, we got into this, you know, we were rode in on this punk, which we weren't really. I mean, we were nothing like the Sex Pistols or the Ramones or anything, you know.
Yes.
And, but, you know, it was hit singles are like little pieces of art, and if people like them, they stand on their own 2 feet. And, you know, people bought it and it got into the charts. And then we were asked to make an album, and which we did, and we wrote in a guy called Terry Cassidy, who was a session singer around at the time. And because basically I was fed up with singing, you know, lead and Hudson. I said, why don't we get like a decent singer in? And so that's how we ended up doing, you know, the Bad Habits album, which, you know,
yes.
How far along the line you want to go with this?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, it's interesting. No, it's interesting because obviously, you know, with Hudson And Ford, you were on, is it A&M and then CBS? So obviously you did four albums with them, which is quite amazing.
Yeah.
And then, so what was it like, again, you know, you'd gone from that 60s period, which changed a lot, the 70s, and then, you know, punk coming in, which often for a lot of, you know, a lot of people, even though they're not that much older when you look back, you know, oh, you're in your 20s, late 20s, but, and there's these kind of little kids, you know, suddenly screaming lyrics and,
you know. They weren't that, actually, in all honesty, they weren't that much. I know, like, John Lydon, he's like a few years younger than I am, you know. They weren't that young, those people, you know. But I, personally, I love that punk thing, because even though I came up with the progressive folk rock thing, I always felt a lot of it was a bit self-indulgent. But I've got to be honest with you, I've never listened to a Genesis album. I've never listened to a Yes album. I mean, I've heard stuff.
Yes.
And I like it, but I'm not... I don't listen to albums. The only albums I listen to are The Strolls, my own, and The Beatles. The only album. Oh, and maybe The Rolling Stones. I never. So when the punk movement came around, I loved it with you know, just strumming the guitar. I thought, this is what I started at doing. I love all this stuff. And so when we made the Monks album, I was doing that, you know, to me in our own way. And The Police, you know, a bit of, you know, the... Andy Summers,
yes,
you know, chorus guitars, all that. We really enjoyed doing that album. I loved, even though it wasn't taken seriously by anybody, really, not in England anyway.
So when you did
when I remember there was a guy, there was a DJ called Kid Jensen.
Oh yes, Kid.
And he played, I think he played "Floating in the Wind," and then he stopped it and he said, "Now this is what they're doing now." And he got and he started playing "Nice Legs Showing About the Place," which I thought was a bit cruel.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is, you're in a business. Music is a business. And you can only do what you've got, what you do, okay? That's all you can do. You've got a talent. It's either good enough or it's not good enough. There's a lot of luck involved. And all the way through these phases that I had, with the soul music, with the psychedelic and the flower power the glam and all that sort of stuff. You just roll along with it, you know, and you just do what you got to do, you know. And if you can write songs and people like them,
you're on a roll. I mean, with the material on Bad Habits with the Monks, you know, like Drugs in My Pocket and Spotty Face, were you kind of channeling the spirit of putting yourself into a kind of a different, you know, age or different sort of identity for that, for writing that material?
Basically, every song was we took like "Nice Legs Showing About the Face," which incidentally, you know, just to go off on a tangent here, I played a club in Manhattan recently, and with all this woke, I'll say it on the air, crap going on, I was asked not to do "Nice Legs Showing About the Face" in case it offended some women, and I did it anyway. So that song. Getting back to what I was saying, was actually a line from my ex-wife, my ex-English wife.
Yes.
When she said to me, we used to, a girl walking out, "Nice Legs Showing About the Face." I thought, oh, that's a good title for a tune. I should have given her royalties. But so that sort of sarcastic look where a guy goes out with someone, he makes her laugh and then she hasn't got a nice face. We took that in the Bad Habits album, and every song on there is like a sarcastic look at, you know, bad habits with them, you know, just a bad kid, you know, going into cinema, getting in for nothing, smoking in the dark. And I can't remember a lot of the other time. We even did one about Dear Jerry, which was a politician, Jerry, an MP, I think he was gay. You couldn't write those sort of songs.
Yes, now. I think
Dear Jerry is about that, yeah. And then the hit record in Canada was called Drugs in My Pocket, and I don't know what to do with them. Couldn't write that now. Yeah. And Terry Cassidy had a very good, aside from being a good singer, he had a good way of putting on voices. And a lot of those tracks had all different voices, Indian voices, you know, Greek voices, you know. You couldn't do that album now without offending somebody, you know. It wasn't meant to be offensive. We just thought it was funny.
Yes.
I still think.
Well, I think it captures that time of the sort of late-ish 70s.
And we did the same with the second album, Suspended Animation, which is about... The actual track "Suspended" is about a robot who's, you know, getting it on with, you know, a female robot, you know, all that stuff, you know. It's just funny, you know.
Yes. I mean, it was kind of an interesting time because 79, when Bad Habits came out, that was when Thatcher got in and then, you know, obviously was in for the next decade and and beyond. And then we had, you know, like the Falkland War, the miners' crisis. Then we had, Greenham Common. We thought we were all going to be, you know, nuked at that stage in life as well. What was it like for you sort of then sort of navigating yourself into the kind of 80s and still kind of keeping interested in music?
Well, when the Monks hit, I thought it, as a musician again, you know, it was like I thought, God, this is like, it was a whole new high, you know. We've got a hit record out of nowhere, and it's like, you know. And at the same time, we were messing around with a third, because I was always a fan of Django Reinhardt, you know, the guitarist.
Yes.
Introduced to me by my father, who was, you know, used to follow him around, and you know, during the war period. And we started writing these songs with like a poppy thing, but with the Django Reinhardt rhythm guitar backing, you know, that sort of junk, 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 junk with the jazzy chords. And we were forming this band called High Society. High Society was actually going before, that's what we came out of Hudson Ford when we started doing that stuff with Jerry Cassidy. And then when the Monks hit, we had to drop the whole thing and go out on these Monks tours, you know. So it was a whole new, I couldn't believe it, you know. It was like, you know, it was just something that came out of thin air, just luck, I suppose.
Yes.
Again, with the music business, there's a lot of luck involved. And when we went to Canada to do, because the thing with Canada, and it was only by sheer bad luck that we didn't hit big in America, because we were signed, I can't even get into this, you know, which is boring, but we were signed to a very tiny label over here that asked too much money for us to be on Capitol Records. Basically, that was it. So, but in Canada, we were still on whatever label we were on, you know, up there. And when we went there, it was like they took the album and the Monks for what it was and not ex-Hudson Ford guys.
Yes.
And we weren't old. We were like, you know, we were just in our 30s, you know, 32, I think I was, you know. So it was like we were a bunch of old guys going over, and it was great. I mean, it was like the tours were great. It was unbelievable.
Yes. Really. And did you, at that stage, did you play any of those kind of clubs like CBGB's or Max's Kansas City or those in New
not
York?
Not as the Monks, no. No, we never came to the US as the Monks.
Oh, right. But
no,
as
we never came. But we did, we were doing big halls, you know, and like, not soccer stadiums. What do they play with the puck thing? On the ice.
Ice hockey. Yeah.
Ice hockey. Yeah. All those sort of stadiums and Massey Hall. We did, which I did previous with Hudson Ford, and we were bigger. And then a few years ago, there was this band called Small Sins, whose whole career was influenced by the Monks, and I went over as a guest of the night. And I'm looking at in my studio wall here is a triple platinum album for Bad Habits that I received on that night.
Excellent.
And they did the whole Bad Habits album in its entirety with all these different singers, and it was great. I couldn't believe it. I got into Toronto. The papers of like the Monks had never left. It's not big articles. Yeah, the Monks, I couldn't believe it. It was unbelievable. Yeah, we had, it was quite a time over there, actually.
Absolutely. So when did you just think with the Monks, two albums, that was kind of enough? And then you went into high
school? Well, the second album, although we got a gold, again, I'm looking at a gold album for Suspended Animation here. The second album didn't do as well as the first album. Okay, so, and then as far as I can remember, I think we went back for another tour, but we never went back again. And then by that time, things started to, you know, again, sort of disintegrate as far as, like, you know, people in the band and stuff. And then, which brings us to, I think it brings us to, like, 80,
cool.
82. I remember 1980, I was painting my front door of my house, and I heard John Lennon die because we got the news like 8 hours after it happened.
But, yes.
So I always remember that, like 1980. And then we did the Straws. Rick Wakeman had a show called Gas Tank. It was like a cable show of his.
It was like a
chat sort of, bands and stuff. And we were asked by, and we were, I think, maybe we were still on tour with the most, I don't know, but all I know is I turned up playing behind Dave Cousins with Ice Shadow. And, a bright red jacket, and there's Dave and Tony in their sort of country boy shirts. And so we were asked to go on there with Rick and we did a performance of Hangman and the Papist.
Excellent.
And then shortly after that, we were asked by the Cambridge, we're talking about 82, 83, Cambridge Folk Festival to do a show at the Cambridge Folk Festival. Rick Wakeman couldn't do it because he was already at something else. So we rode Blue Weaver in, and that went down a storm. I remember it poured with the rain halfway through the set, and everyone stood up, and it was like magical. It was unbelievable. And then, from then on, we started doing these, I think we did a couple of things with the band, with Blue Weaver again, and Tony Hooper. There was me, Hudson, Brian Willoughby, Dave Cousins, Tony Hooper, and Blue Weaver in that lineup. And then we went to America to do, I think it was part of the reunion tour, which was in 1984,
right.
Christmas. And we were playing at this place called The Bottom Line, which is now defunct. And we did like 3 or 4 nights there. We were still big in, big over there. And then on that very night, I met who I didn't know at the time, was to be my wife, to be American wife. And I moved over here the next year. And then I sort of left the Straubs, and I suppose I was still in it at the time. And then that I've been here ever since.
Blimey, 1984, the mid-80s, you'd done it.
I was over here.
And then, with the occasional reunion with the Straubs, but then it's, kind of full-on solo career, isn't it, from then on?
Well, the solo career, I wasn't really, my solo career was like nothing. I didn't come here, I didn't come here as a career move, musical career. I came here because of my son's mother,
yes.
Basically, and... which, when I think back on it, coming over here at 36 was not a good idea. But, I'm still here. But anyway, so what happened, I came over here, we were together, and I got a call from the Straubs agent. He said, I've got Rick Wakeman over here on tour. He said, would you like to open? I said, I'm a bass player of the Straubs. I'm not a solo act. He said, well, I'm sure you can think of something. So I went on and opened up for Rick with acoustic guitar. I hadn't really no songs of any worth. Other than Part of the Union and a couple of Straubs things, but somehow I got through it. And I thought, I sort of like this solo thing, And I've been, and I stayed here, and, and that was it.
Still. Yes, but High Society didn't last that long then as a sort of a project.
No, not really. Although Hudson and Terry Cassidy, they did reform it and do some shows, obviously without me. They did carry on and do some stuff.
Yes.
But there was a lot of good songs that came out of the High Society. The only problem was that it was, the whole image was like a sort of a non-starter. Terry Cassidy was singing in this sort of high society sort of singing voice, a bit like the old crooners in the
30s,
that sort of stuff. But there was a lot of good songs on there, and if someone, would take them and make a show out of it, that it would really be great. But it's never happened. I suppose it will never happen. But,
So when did you decide then to sort of think, right, I'm going to start writing material? Was this the kind of the 90s that you started to, or the late mid-90s?
Oh, writing material over here?
Yeah, for your solo career.
Yeah, my solo, sort of immediately, because I'm one of those people, I can't stop writing songs, okay? I may not write for a couple of years sometimes, but sometimes I wake up in the morning and I've got a tune in my head. I just can't help it, Oh, I hear something on the radio and I mispronounce a line. And I thought, that's a good line. Did they really say that? Because I don't want to get into any plagiarism or anything. That's what it's, so we. I'm always doing something, and if I, and now, you know, with iPhones, I can just sing something in the phone and go back to it later. You know, you didn't have that facility in the old days because all you had was a tape recorder, and it was, you know, things are so short. So it's a lot easier. No, I think I've had about, I don't know, about 10 solo albums, including like 2 Christmas albums.
Yes.
None of them have sold a million, but they've, people like them, I suppose.
Yes. And, so I was listening, because you started with Love is the Highway. Was that the first solo album you put out?
Yeah, that was the first one. I had this old sort of Tascam 8-track. And that was another thing. Although I'd been in recording studios all my life, I was never interested in the technical side of it. To me, you know, the producer and the engineer were doing the sound. We either liked it or we didn't like it. When I came over here and I suddenly got into gear, and I'm looking at all this gear here in my studio. I just love when I need inspiration to write a song. I just buy a new piece of gear. It doesn't matter what it is. Like, it could be a compressor or, you know, something stupid. It just gives me inspiration. When I come back from the store, I'm getting a new synthesizer. But yeah, I mean, and I got into gear. I had this old 8-track. I had 7 tracks. The drums ran on a sync track, and I recorded that first Love is the Highway album. In fact, I never even had a CD player. I was sending stuff out on cassettes at that point.
Right.
But, you know, it was fun. You know, it was fun. And when I listen back to it now, they sound pretty awful. But now the last 3 albums have been sounding pretty good because the technology's changed, you know.
Yes, absolutely. That's been fantastic. Yeah, because I've been listening to your latest ones because they're kind of easy to hear. But there was one, Life is a Foreign Town. That one came out 2 years ago, didn't it? Was there this?
I recorded that right in the middle of the pandemic, basically, most of it.
Right.
In fact, we did a video that went worldwide of one song on there called All Locked Down, about the pandemic. So I have to write. See, that's how I write. I have to write topical songs, and I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, what the hell rhymes with quarantine? And I come in there, we're all locked down in quarantine, I got all the band to my. Well, it was all me on the recording because we couldn't go out, so I did everything. But the band mimed their parts. And we sent it off to the show, I think it was Jam 69, I can't remember the name of the place. But it was out of Florida, the guy producer, and he got all these acts from all around the world who couldn't go out with the pandemic. And we sent him the 4, you know, videos of each person in my band. And if you go on my Facebook, you can see it all locked down. But yeah, so that whole album was basically done in 20, as was the Straubs album Settlement, which again we all did, you know, via computer.
Yes, so Settlement. But then, is there a new Straubs album called The Magic of It All? Is that?
Yep. We did that the same way.
Right,
the same way.
So just to get the chronological kind of narrative here, when you were in America, did you do much work with the Straubs apart from the occasional reunion tour, or did you continue recording with them?
No, around 2000, I went over to England to do the 30th anniversary, which was done in, where was that done? Chiswick or somewhere.
Right.
And then we had some tours after that, around 2001 and 2002, and then they formed the Acoustic Force, which was Brian Willoughby and Dave Lambert. And then I came over again for the 40th, which was done at, where was that done? Some stadium, rugby stadium in...
Twickenham. Twickenham?
Twickenham, right, yeah, that was it. It did that, and then we had albums, you know, there was a Strawberry Fair album on that. And then just prior to the pandemic, 2019, the 50th was done in New Jersey over here, which was pretty easy for me because I don't live that far. And that was great. That was a great, we had everyone on that. I mean, Blue Weaver flew over. We had the existing band, you know, Lambert, Chas Kronk.
Yes.
And we had Tony Visconti came and conducted the orchestra. We had Annie Haslam, who was did some vocals.
Was she in Renaissance?
Yep. She lives over here as well.
Yes.
We all move over here. And just as a footnote, I don't know whether you know this, but around 97, I hooked up with Richie Blackmore, who also lives on Long Island. You know, Richie Blackmore from...
Yes.
He lives a bit further out than me. He lives further east than me. And he wasn't doing Rainbow or Deep Purple. And he, at that time in 97, he just formed with his wife Blackmore's Night, which is like a medieval folky thing.
I know, it's brilliant.
I really liked. I mean, I really... And I was on the second album. I sang a song on there.
Oh, was that Under a Violet Moon?
Under a Violet. Under a Violet Moon. I'll say Violet Moon. Yeah, and me, him and her, before they actually formed the band, we used to just turn up at clubs because Richie didn't want people to know who he was because, you know, there'd be a big crowd then.
Yes.
We used to turn up at these bars, sing a few songs and then just walk out again. And I was, so we made the album, and which I thought the stuff was great. And Richie is a real sort of perfectionist. I wasn't really aware. I mean, I'd heard of Richie Blackmore, of course, but I wasn't aware of how great he was.
No.
Until I saw him I was in the same room and he plays the acoustic guitar. He's out of this world. He really is. So anyway, I sort of was about to go on tour with them because he likes tour in Germany and castles and all that. But then I went on tour with the Strawbs prior to that, and we had a bit of a falling out over that. And I never recorded with them since then. But they've done well. I mean, they've had about two dozen albums out, you know.
Yes, and, they're always...
had a couple of kids in the interim, you know.
Candace.
Yeah, they were great. I enjoyed it. Yeah, Candace, nice. She's great.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it's great. I really like... It's a nice change, isn't it, when you can sort of hear somebody who's doing something completely different and probably saved his hearing in the meantime. So with the Straub, my God, the Straubs have been very busy, haven't they? So you did the tour. Was that the 2012 tour you mentioned that you toured with them, or was that... I'm getting confused.
Going back to early 2000, we did 2000 tour. And maybe 2001, I can't remember exactly. And then I never did anything until the 30th anniversary, which would have been, hang on, what year was that? I can't remember. It was right in the middle of 2000.
Yes.
And then the 40th, by the way, the 40th was around 2009. So it may have been 99, maybe. But yeah, probably 99, that 30th. And then the pandemic, prior pandemic, was 2019 April, a few years back, and then and then after that, Dave approached me. He sent me some lyrics, and the thing about that is Dave and I have never written in the whole of the Straubs career together, other than collaborate on stuff like, I don't know whether you're familiar with, like Tears and for Van, where I wrote a bit of an instrumental there and he added the lyrics. But as far as like writing together, we've never done that. So that is quite a, it's great. I mean, for me, I can't even come close to his lyrics.
Yes.
To me. So he sent me these lyrics, which was to be Each Manner of Man. And I think I either already had a tune already or I wrote one to these, I can't remember. And then that became that. And then that's how we did that album. And, of course, with the Settlement album, there was contributions from Dave Lambert and Chas Kronk and the usual, the lineup. I think they had Dave Bainbridge on the keyboards.
Yes.
That's
great.
And the new one is, that is a whole different ballgame. That is, I've got two tunes on there with Dave. One is a Christmas song called Christmas Ghosts, which Dave has, he's taken... A lot of Charles Dickens's titles and woven them into this sort of Christmas song, which was very clever. And then I've got one other song called where I can't remember the title now. He changed the title so many times. Our World. We did that.
Right.
And then the rest of the stuff is mainly all his. I think he's written a couple with Blue Weaver as well. on that.
Yes.
So yeah, that's coming out. That should be out in to coincide with this little tour we're doing.
Blimey, because this one is going to be quite a consciousness raising exercise, isn't it? The magic of it all. Is it to do with his kind of interest in struggles of in South Africa?
The magic of it all?
Yes.
What, the song, you mean?
No, but the album. I'm just kind of reading the bit, actually, on Cherry Red Records, actually, talking about, we're high on the charts.
Dave recently found out that the Strolls were bigger in South Africa than we ever knew. So he went over there and did a few successful solo tours and met up with a bass player called Shork Juba. I don't know how to pronounce his name. Shork Juba or Jubert. And he did some shows with him, bass player and acoustic guitar. And so it came to be that when they've decided to do the album over there, at least the backing tracks, and he flew over with Blue Weaver, and he asked me to go, but me being really on the other side of the world, I couldn't really get over there. It was too much of a...
Yes.
Too much for me just to fly, like 24 hours. I would like to have gone, but... So they did... The backing tracks became what is to be, the new album. Blue Weaver produced it and then did all the songs, and then was brought back to... Blue Weaver lives in Germany, and he produced it and got it all together from there. And throughout last summer... I was doing, vocals, refining the lyrics, refining the tunes and all the lyrics. And so basically that's it. I mean, whatever else you've heard.
Yes. I mean, it was what's amazing, because I think the cover is absolutely stunning. And it's quite an unusual one for the Strawbs, isn't it? In the sense it's quite a different image that it's projecting.
Yes, I can't tell you anything about that because it was designed by the label, the label.
Cherry Red.
And I think Dave said he chose it because he just thought it was a great colour.
Yes.
And the inside sleeves are good as well because it's got all the lyrics with all the people who are performing on it. And there's a lot of women on there. Catherine Craig, who appeared with us on the 50th anniversary. She's a singer, wife of Brian Willoughby, who's also going to be on this tour.
Yes.
Is on there. Plus the three South African guys, the rhythm section. And Blue on keyboards, Dave on guitar, and me doing a lot of singing.
Blimey.
And, yeah, it's,
And
the actual tune, Dave's tune, The Magic of It All, is basically a chronological sort of, at least the way I read it, of the whole Strawbs' career, from when they started off.
Yes.
Sort of, it gets through and goes through that, which is quite nice.
Because I know that it was Dave who had a song called The Water Song, and that was that kind of South African...
That emanated from that when he was over there, and I think he wrote a tune or lyrics to some tune, and kids all sang that. Yeah, I mean, and also, I think he's got a charitable thing there about getting water to these poor communities. I don't know much about it, but it's all going on today. But yeah, I mean, apparently they love the Strawbs in South Africa. I mean, who do?
there was a film, wasn't there? The Sugar Man. It was about this guy who made an album and just became a cleaner, and then found out he was massive in America. In Africa, he was like bigger than Elvis, and he then sort of in later life became resurrected his life for a brief period before he sadly passed away. So yes, these things happen, don't they? It's kind of interesting.
Yeah.
But with the you've got some live dates in the summer, haven't you? This is important. You've got...
Yes, yes.
And this is going to be...
We have... first of all, yeah, the Strolls were approached to do the Fairport Convention Festival, Cropperty.
Yeah.
I think that's out in Oxford somewhere, isn't it? I've never been there.
Yes.
So that is happening on August the 11th.
Excellent.
And then we got two shows at Trading Boundaries. On the 6th and the 7th I'm not sure what days are. I think it's Sunday and Monday. And then we got another, the Tower Theatre, which I think is somewhere in the Folkestone area. Don't quote me on that. I'm not sure.
No.
That's on the 9th. So it's all leading up to the Croppery Festival.
Yes. And when you get back together, do you have a quick rehearsal or do you just have to...
Oh, yeah. We'll be rehearsing, okay. Were you joking? Yeah, we'll definitely be rehearsing. There's a lot of big rehearsals coming up.
Does it feel quite, you know, because I know, you know, as we all get older, health becomes a thing, and Dave's had quite a few health moments as well recently. Does it feel quite special with the band, you know, knowing that, you know, as we all get, you know, in our autumn years, that this is probably the last, is this going to be the last album, do you think, with the band?
I'm not too sure about that. Dave is such a trooper, you know, even with his health issues. The fact that he's doing this and organising everything like he always did, I don't think this is going to be the last, by no means. I mean, I've seen Dave, he's been deathly ill, you know, during the past, couldn't even speak. He's gone and done the best vocals he's ever done in his life, you know. I don't think that for 1 minute. I mean, maybe, you know, I'm guesting here. I mean, I haven't been asked to rejoin. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm just sort of doing a guest spot over here. In fact, I was never really asked to join. Dave said to me, when I first went to the White Bear, he said, well, what are you doing Tuesday? And that was it. And I was in the band. Never asked me. He said, what are you doing Tuesday? And yeah, I mean, you know, yeah, Dave is, he'll still be going.
Yes. And you mentioned you've got an album you're writing at the moment, and that's coming out. Is that this year or next year?
I think it's more likely next year, because I've got half a dozen tracks now. So, but I'm not doing anything because my mind's too fixed on this Straubs thing. So by the time I get back, it'll be like, you know, the autumn. And so, no, I'll probably be next year. But I already have a title. It's called Who Stopped the World. The track is already done.
Yes.
Who Stopped the World. Again, topical track, Who Stopped the World, Who Derailed the Train. You know, it's you know, all to do with the pandemic stuff and all that stuff. World's going to hell in a handbasket while we're worrying about doing shows. You know?
And do you sort of still just play live in clubs around?
Oh, yeah, I did a show a couple of weeks ago. Not far from where I live on Long Island. It's not a big place, you know, about 300 seats. I still draw a decent crowd, but I don't do, as I say, a lot of the cover bands around it, they're all doing bars. I used to do bars when I first came here just for the hell of it, you know, because it was a novelty for me, but I don't do them anymore.
Yes.
You got to play. My son, who's also got a band here called Lucky Dangerous, he has the same problem because he's not a cover band, and his stuff is more like sort of Green Day and loosely on Green Day and Ramones. And,
yes.
But he has the same problem, even though he's like 30 and he's young, because he's not, you know, these bars want to, you know, who you're going to draw, what stuff do you play when someone playing Pink Floyd, and he has the same sort of problem. So, but yeah, I did. So we did about a 2-hour show a couple of weeks ago. I still enjoy it. It's great.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, if you could have whispered something to your, like, 16-year-old self starting out in this interesting world and career, is there anything in particular you might have just sort of said, oh, yeah, by the way, I would focus on that, or I'd check that out a bit more, or would you think, what the hell?
I would have said to him, stay with your first British wife. That's what I would say. Because American women, they're out there, I'm telling you. Anyway, I don't know what I would have said, because, again, it's a series of events where, if I hadn't have got that audition in 1967 with the Five Proud Walkers, where Richard Hudson was already in the band, like playing the drums, if I hadn't have got that, I don't know where my life would have... Because from there, I went to all these doors opened, with Elmer Gantry, with the Straws, with, you know, And eventually, I wouldn't be sitting here on Long Island if it wasn't for those, you know, all those opportunities. And it, as I say, being a musician, it's a lot of luck. And I don't know what I would have, I don't know whether I could have done anything different as far as being a musician. I wouldn't have taken a different path, because you can only do what you can do. You're of a, to me, your development as a musician is, you get it when you're a teenager. You know, all these, you know, the Beatles, they did all their stuff when they were teenagers, and that's what sticks with you. You don't really get it. I suppose you get better, but it's all there. But by the time you're 20, you don't suddenly become really good when you're like 45. You know, and you've either got it or you haven't.
Yes,
and that's basically what it is. So I don't know. I think there's a couple of things I couldn't say on the radio. I would have done different, but the as far as the music thing, I don't know. I don't think so.
No.
Just roll with it.
You know? And if you were to, you know, someone said, look, what would you recommend for your incredible catalogue and discography? Which kind of album or albums would you say, yeah, they're the ones that I'm really proudest of? You know, because...
that's a hard question. I think the milestone ones, I mean, we've got to skate over... the Elmer Gantry stuff, but the milestone things are, you know, the Straub's Grave New World, which is considered, you know, almost a cult album now.
Yeah.
And Bursting at the Seams was good, and Hudson Ford. I mean, you know, yeah, I don't know. It's hard. I mean, it's hard to ask. You know, you always like what you do. I mean, there's some things I don't like. You know, there's some, like Hudson Ford's last album, I don't like that. Like, we did Bacerius, that wasn't good. We've got one good song on there. But, and I also think, you know, again, I'm happy doing my solo stuff. And of course, I'm going to like that. I mean, you know, I'm not the greatest singer in the world, but I'm sort of passable. And I think I've written some of my best songs over here on my solo albums, even though, you know, they're not like million sellers and things, you know, but so, you know, it's up there.
Yes, and that's amazing. I mean, it's just incredible that 50 years and people are still picking over the band and getting very excited, you know, with the Straubs. And
the Straubs sort of seem to, as Blue Weaver said, because Blue, you know, left when we did, and he went into he hooked up with the Bee Gees, and he was with all that, you know, all those recordings of, you know, Jive Talking, all that stuff.
Yes.
Played the keyboard. And he said, although you leave the Straubs, you never really leave, because somehow you're always drawn back in. And I don't, you know, I find it fascinating, you know, at my age, which we won't discuss at the moment, that I'm back playing with the Straubs again. It's unbelievable.
Yes, you can. Yes. It's a bit
good,
like...
you know, yeah.
It's like that Hotel California, isn't it? You can check out, but you can never...
Yeah, that's good. That's a good analogy.
It's always going to drag you in. And I guess you're always getting new fans, aren't you? I think that's the thing. People are always...
Yeah, and it's good, because I really, you know, I think Dave chooses musicians that he knows that are you know, they know how to approach and play on his music. Like he said... Like this last album, he sent me all these vocals, you know, lead, and I know immediately what to do on it as far as the harmonies. You know, I send them back, and he checks them over. And it's always been the same with any member of the Straubs. You know, Lambert, Kronk, Hudson, you know, Blue or Rick Wakeman. You adhere to this sort of goal, and you know what to do. It's why it's always been with this with Dave stuff, you know?
Yes, and it's great that people have been, you know, they bring out these kind of amazing photographs from 50 years ago, black and white photographs in pubs and clubs and backstage, and they're so evocative. So with this kind of these dates, will Rick appear at all, did you say? Or
No, Rick's gone way beyond the Straubs. He was appearing a few miles from me in a venue called the Paramount, in a place called Huntington, on his solo too. No, Rick won't play with us. But his younger son is Adam, I think. He's on the bill.
Yes,
playing the keyboards as well. Yeah.
Imagine.
So let me tell you the lineup there. The lineup is Dave Cousins, myself on acoustic guitar singing, Blue Weaver on keyboard, synthesizers, Catherine Craig vocals, Brian Willoughby lead guitar, and I think there's one other girl singer called Catherine, can't read my own writing, Shanda, I can't remember. But the guys, the South African guys are Shaq Joubert, Kevin, I can't read their names, because I haven't met these guys yet. And yeah, you'll have to check that out.
Oh, Kevin, there's a Kevin Gibson.
I think it's Gibson.
Yes, there is quite a lot of interest in names on that album.
So that's basically the rhythm section.
Yes, yeah. it's going to channel the spirit of Graceland and put Paul Simon at this rate, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they have got that sort of feel, which is giving this album a different feel. It's more of a sort of a jazzy, sort of looser feel.
Yes, a bit of high life. That'll be fascinating. Yeah. And your fans, they seem very protective of the band, don't they? The Straubs fans are, you know, they're very committed. It's like a religion, isn't it, the band? You know, the...
Yeah, well, yeah. Have you been on the Straubs site recently?
I had a quick look and thought, oh, blimey, I'm stepping away here.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, it's... it's a delicate subject, which I've had nothing to do with. I mean, but, you know, Dave Lambert and Chas Kronk and Tony Fernandez and Dave Brandy won't be appearing on this. Although Dave did offer them to appear. I know that, but they won't be appearing.
Yes.
But as I say, it's not my decision. Nothing to do with it.
I know.
And what goes on, you know, with them internally is... I've been out of the band too long to know what goes on.
It's the perfect place to be, isn't it, really? You just don't want to... It gets a bit cobwebby. You get a bit stuck up and, confused. It's probably
but,
a little...
You know, that's being in a band. I mean, it's like, you know, it's a very democratic sort of situation that you're in with any band. And it's, you know... Stuff happens, you know.
Yes.
Although when I appeared with them at the, it was great seeing them. You know, Chaz is a great guy, Lambert. In fact, I lent Lambert my Vox. I bought a couple of Vox because I still use Vox AC30s over here, and I bought two of them to the show, and I was very happy that he used my amplifier all the way through the show. But yeah, we get on great. Tony Fernandez is great, but you know, this is the lineup that's happening on these shows.
It's going to be brilliant. It's going to be fresh. It's going to be exciting. Anyway, and the sun will shine and you'll have a great summer. So it's better than lockdown, isn't it? But I hope your next solo album comes out soon. Well, you said next year, so I hope that goes well.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes. Well, look, thank you ever so much for your time. This has been amazing. And yes, like I said, so many memories of so many of your songs. So it's been great. Yes. But anyway, look, again, thank you ever so much. And I have to say that this time the reception was so much easier. So there you go.
Oh, it's great. This is how usually when I do calling, it's sometimes better than, you know, calling locally. Yeah, it's good. But it's been a great pleasure talking to you.
Yes.
I don't know how I remember all this stuff, but
it's
still
there.
Do.
Look, take care. And yes, all the best for the summer and this year.
Yeah, thank you, David. Thank you.
Take care. See you later. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.
And that was me in conversation with the amazing John Ford. As we went through all those musical bands, I won't repeat them, and I could do. Anyway, you'll find out more information on various social media platform sites. John is on Facebook, so you can find out more about his releases and also the Straubs here, there and everywhere. This has been the C86 Show, David East. So if you want to contact me for some nice reason or groovy, who knows, or leave some nice feedback, you can on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, just do C86 Show. Yes, there you go. All these interviews have been archived. Aren't you lucky? Find those on Spotify, iTunes, Podbeam. It's true. Anyway, have a great week. Stay safe.